that use fiat currency as a store of value. We call them poor. We call them poor. People that use fiat currency. We call them poor. We call them poor. We call them poor. We call them poor. There's a name for it. We call them poor. We call them poor. Okay.
Right. Like, the point is, if you have the superior asset, it's going up forever, Lauren. Forever.
Right. I mean. Right, but I
mean,
we should all...
Woo! Here we go. Welcome back. 2026. True North, the Investment Grade Bitcoin Podcast, episode 50. Let's get everybody up on stage. We are back. We are going to hit it hard. There's so much to talk about. All right. Is everybody refreshed from a little bit of time off? I can tell you I am. I'm ready to go. There's a lot to be excited about here, and I'm excited to talk about it. So welcome to, let me see if I can get my screen off. Maybe not. There we go. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Here we go. We call them poor. okay. True North, the Investment Grade Bitcoin Podcast. This is a podcast about Bitcoin and how it's infiltrating the financial markets. We talk about all things Bitcoin. We talk about strategy. We talk about Bitcoin treasury companies. We talk about securitized finance. We talk about digital credit, we talk about digital capital, how it's all getting integrated into the market. And then we also talk about just general macro environment and finance. So this collective crew we've brought together, we've been talking about this for about 65 weeks in a row now, and excited to get that back to it for 2026. Thank God we made it through 2025. What a crappy year. We made it through. And congratulations to everybody for making it through. That was a terrible year. However, every setback is a setup for a comeback. And a lot of this episode is to talk about everything that's going on in this market environment. We're talking about what is the outlook for 2026 and what is potentially on the horizon here in the digital credit environment for Bitcoin and the infrastructure that sits behind it. I think there's a lot going on. We'll talk about macro environment with Dan. He's got a little bit of a presentation. We're going to do a macro speed run. We're going to get into the pref landscape. Effectively, what is the status of the perpetual preferred equities? How have they performed since they were launched? What is the environment in which they've had to operate in? We'll talk about some pension funds and get into insurance companies and strategic finance. What's happening on the back end? Like, how does demand change over time? And then we'll talk about 2026 and the horizon. Maybe we'll make some guesstimates on how much Bitcoin MSTR is going to hold at the end of the year for 2026, and maybe some Bitcoin estimates for what kind of performance we're going to see throughout the year. And thank you. See everybody in the chat. Thank you for popping in the chat. It's awesome. And yeah, please let us know where you're from, what you're up to, and yeah, let's get cooking. Hold on. My mic is fuzzy. Can you guys hear me now? Better? Yeah? Okay. Cool. All right. Well, let's jump right into it. STRC had a fantastic day. So we are STRC is at a price of $99. It closed at 100 even. We think there was a significant amount of capital that was raised today as STRC was bouncing right at par. So exciting day on that front. And let's jump into it. Maybe we'll pass it over to Tim. Maybe we'll do a round circle. Just what are you guys thinking about right now in 2026? What are things that are top of mind? And what's going on with you guys? Let's pass it around.
Well, number one, what you're about to hear may be amazing, but it's not financial advice.
Oh, in real life.
It's for informational and educational purposes only. So
not financial advice, even in 2026.
Yeah, maybe 2027. I don't know. But I think digital. I think digital credit's the theme of the year. You know, if 2025 was year zero, as you've said, Jeff, then 2026 mathematically has got to be year one. That's all I got.
Yeah, it's about a year old, and you're interviewing everybody in the entire market to talk about this stuff. So a lot cooking. Keep up the good work. Mason, what are you thinking about? What's going on in Brazil? Just a state of the market. What's going on? You did a stock buyback.
Yeah. Can you guys hear me? We're doing share buybacks at Melius, and it's exciting, you know, increasing Bitcoin per share by any means possible. So we're about 40% through our goal, which is 10% of the free float. That's, you know, the advantage of having a cash flowing business. We're able to take our cash flow and buy Bitcoin or our stock at any price. So actually it's a little counterintuitive. As Bitcoin goes down, our Bitcoin per share goes up, or at least our projections. So we're feeling good. We're feeling strong, and yeah, excited for the new year.
Heck yeah. Great work. Great work, Mason. Over to you,
Let's
Dan.
Go, Mason.
Launch of Buck Token. We got a treasure of a new preferred equity token, a preferred equity backed token. That's exciting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm super, super excited. We launched yesterday, January 6th, and we already have $1 million of total value locked. The token is, our Twitter's Buck Token, but we, you know, our treasury earnings are come directly from our Stretch holdings, STRC. And I think it's going to be just a great sort of product built on top of the prefs, and a really good way to bring these, you know, equitized Bitcoin products, Stretch and the preferreds, to the broader market that's crypto native and isn't necessarily in the US.
Bingo. I love it. Off to a hot start. I mean, this is how this stuff scales, right? People find out, because these products have such a high yield, you're able to build within them, right? There's such a big delta between the risk-free rate, you're able to create an entire business model that fits in between with the delta of the yield. So super exciting. It's effectively the digital money concept that Saylor talked about in Abu Dhabi, and you're out to market with it. So cool. Congrats.
So excited. Thanks for the support, guys.
Yeah, 100%. Over Soleil, what's going on? How many episodes are into the Orange Pill Investor podcast are you? You're still ripping it.
546.
Just relentless execution, just every day. And you're building up a Noster. We've got more spam wars here in 2026. You're leading the charge there. What's on your mind?
Yep, every day is an all-time high on the number of episodes. Yeah, I can't stop, I guess, talking about spam wars. I think Quantum FUD was probably a distraction to take people's minds off of spam. But there's good news. We got a BIP110 proposal that may move a solution to the base layer. There's some extreme suggestions out there. It's called the CAT, which would actually freeze some of those spam transactions. I think that the benefit of something like that is more just to put the fear of God into the spammers. So hopefully nothing that drastic would need to take place.
All right. Keep on keeping on. Stay on top of it. Over to you, Grain. You made a book, AI, you're building apps. Look at you. Look at you go. So proud of you.
thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. So one of the interesting parts that I'll talk about. So where do I see 2026? I see it being positive. I think every year builds and gets better. We learn more and more. You know, what I did recently, look, I wrote a book, and what I'll tell everybody, the book itself wasn't important. The important part was I completed a project. I said I wanted to write a book. I wrote the book. I published it. It's on Kindle. You could download it. Didn't sell a lot of copies. That wasn't the point. What I wanted to do is I wanted to compress that book, and I did a video in 8 minutes. You could run it in 2x speed, and you could be like, wow. Okay, now it's 4 minutes. And I'm like, that's not good enough. So I compressed the book down to a post. And that's the post that went viral. And it's a little bit over 5 million impressions. So from that perspective, you would ask me a week ago, do you think that I could write a post that can do 5 million impressions? Absolutely not. I'd say possible, but 5 million never. And so what I did was, is I kind of wrote a tweet that means you don't have to buy my book. And that's the point I want to get across. You just have to think about, you know, exactly what Mason just said over there, was that they're buying back shares in order to increase the amount of Bitcoin per share. That's an important takeaway. And then I think what Dan is saying is incredibly important. What he did, congratulations, Dan. I'm proud of you. I mean, where we were literally a year and a half ago, I don't think anybody could have predicted this. And if I had a real Coke, I'd crack it open here. But, you know, Dan, congratulations. The concept that digital credit would be invented, it would go live, and then there's companies that are now building a token on top of that to give double the yield of U.S. treasuries. I never thought that was not on my bingo card. Yeah, that was on my bingo card. So what am I seeing? I think that everybody's going to continue building this in here. You got Mason that's flying down to South America, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, look at everything we did in the last year, and now we're just getting started, right? This is year one. Let's put our foot on the gas. We can build on this stuff. Everybody's working hard. So good stuff, Mike. Over to you, Adrian. Are we going to get some more lessons on quantum, or we just dispel the FUD and you can be the teacher? Everybody can drop out of that class and, you know, we can have some giggles here in 26 too.
Yeah, no, I think 26 is poised to be a good year. The quantum FUD that was at the end of the year was a little bit strange, but, you know, it pops up every 3 months, and I do what I can to try to dispel any of the nonsense whenever I see it. But, you know, I've been watching Stretch pretty closely. I think that has potential to be something really, really successful. I think it's already has been successful, and I think a lot of people have been kind of clamoring for it to fail, but it's been holding steady, and it's been holding the peg, and it's been attracting a lot of attention. So, especially with the project that Dan's working on, and there's just a lot of stuff going on in the space right now that we couldn't have foreseen 6, 9, 12 months ago. So I'm pretty interested to see what happens in 2026. I'm not going to make any predictions other than I don't think that we're going to see a continuation of the cycle in previous years. I don't see like an 80% drawdown in our future, or another, what, 40% from here, whatever it is. I don't see that. Yeah, I don't see that happening. Very curious to see what happens with AI. Very curious to see what happens with Bitcoin. Want to know if we're going to have any movement on the SBR finally, maybe, hopefully, potentially. But besides that, really curious to see what the year's going to bring.
Awesome. And look forward to it. I know you've got some analysis. Maybe we can get into it later in the stream. We're looking at ATM as a percent of total volume over 2025. I was doing some analysis earlier. It looked like Strategy traded about a $1.2 trillion worth of volume in 2025.
That's about right. Yeah, I had a post about that, yeah.
Which is just a staggering statistic, right? Just $1.2 trillion in volume throughout the entire year. So totally crazy. Let's start, as we have almost every single stream, walking through the statistics of the Strategy balance sheet, because they are the leaders here. They've got 673,000 Bitcoin. I'm going to share my screen. And then we'll jump into Dan. We'll do a macro speed run and talk about the landscape of the market before we get into other things. That works for you guys. Also, apparently we've got some like choppiness in the audio, some lag on the stream.
Yeah, people are saying it's only on YouTube. So if you can join on X, that might help.
Join on X if you can. We've just got too much alpha, right? Too much alpha on here where it's making the audio choppy. You know, that it happens. Okay, let's get into it, because I think this is a fantastic story. You know, one thing I've reflected a lot about here in the last, I don't know, couple of weeks is just thinking about what's happened over the last year. And how has the Strategy balance sheet changed? And in what perspective am I looking at? Am I looking at a fiat perspective? Am I looking at a Bitcoin perspective? Is the story better than it was a year ago? How do I feel about the balance sheet? Is it healthy? What's the market look like? And so I'm going to run through this here. So and maybe I'll hide this for a moment. So as of today, January 7th, 2026, Strategy holds 673,000 Bitcoin on the balance sheet. Bitcoin price as of when I did this, about 91,000. So the assets held on the balance sheet is about $61.5 billion. The Strategy price is $162 per share. The USD reserve on the balance sheet is $2.25 billion, which is massive. That's increased significantly just over the last couple of weeks. They've effectively got enough cash dividends to pay 2.5 years worth of dividends, which is just an insane statistic. Then we look at the debt on the balance sheet. So the debt is about $8.2 billion compared to where it was last year. It's up about, what is that, about $900 million. Preferred stock issued, $7.9 billion. So if you look at the net capital, the assets less just the debt on the balance sheet, you're looking at, actually, hold on, that number is wrong. So that plus that, minus that. The net capital on the balance sheet is $55.6 billion. You take $61 billion plus $2.2 billion of USD. You know, if you just subtract all of the assets less the debt, you'd have $55.6 billion. This is up 63% year over year. The Bitcoin held is up 51% year over year. Bitcoin is down, what was it, 5% year over year. So a massive change there. Annual preferred dividend payment, $831. Net capital years of dividends. So if you're just to take that $55.6 million figure and divide the $831 million of annual pref dividend payment, they can pay the dividend for 72 years. Crazy statistic. There's not another balance sheet on the planet that has enough capital to pay their debt obligations for 72 years. That is an insane statistic. We're talking about the year 2100-ish. If I'm around, that would be awesome. You know, it's so far from now. It's hard to fathom. Then you look at the debt ratio. So effectively the leverage ratio. And the leverage ratio has gone from 18.2% down to 9.7%. So the leverage ratio is actually down 47% year over year. So you're telling me they increased the Bitcoin held by 51% and the leverage is down by 47%? That's a healthy balance sheet. That looks incredibly healthy if you denominate your view of this world in Bitcoin. You look at the coverage multiple. Well, the coverage multiple is down 31%. You've gone from 5.5 down to 3.8. But what's going on there? Well, they've issued the perpetual preferred equity. The perpetual preferred equity is so unique because that capital investment comes in the door and they have a dividend obligation, but they never have to pay that capital back. There's no maturity. So that's permanent capital held on the balance sheet to pay that interest obligation. So that's why the amplification figure is different from the leverage figure. The leverage takes into consideration debt that has a maturity that they have to pay back. So when you look at the balance sheet, you're like, okay, the Bitcoin held is up 51%. The amplification is actually up 40%. And they've reduced the cliff maturity on the balance sheet. That's a great story. That's a healthy balance sheet. And the Bitcoin price for the assets to be worth less than the debt, that's gone from $16,900 down to $11,800. So it's got to go down, which is a 30% decrease year over year. So the percent drawdown needed for the assets to be worth less than the debt on the balance sheet would be an 87% drawdown. I like the story. It looks really good. So let's
before you change, I want to go to your particular row and column row here. So it's row 30.
Yep.
And what you're talking about is this is the leverage ratio. So it's below 10% now. This is where we've talked about this on many episodes before. If you go to buy a house today, you put down 20% and you're levered 5-1. And everybody's like, yeah, so strategy, you know, their leverage is 10. No. They have it's the flip side of this. I have yet to figure out an easy way. I've tried explaining this multiple times, but this ratio is the exact opposite of what everybody thinks. So what they're saying is that they have 90% of all their assets. There's only 9.7% that is the actual debt, which is the exact opposite of way leverage is typically discussed. And that's why this doesn't make sense to most people, because they're like, oh yeah, it's pretty close to like putting 20% down on a house. Now, this would be the equivalent if you went to go buy a $1 million house, your down payment would be $900,000. I mean,
exactly.
If you're buying a $500,000 house, right, a $500,000 house, you would put down $450,000 as your down payment. And only 50 grand of that would be your debt. Nobody does that.
Nobody does that.
That's right. the strength of the balance sheet, right? And then like
that's the strength of the balance. And I it kills me that I can't figure out an easy way to get that across, because your metrics are correct.
Yeah. Yeah. When you think about yourself, right, like with a house, if I had a $500,000 house and a $450,000 down payment, your question becomes, what's the probability that I go bankrupt and I'm not able to pay the debt on my balance sheet? It's like, I'm going to figure out how to pay this interest payment, right? Like I'm going to be able to figure out. It's not hard, right? You figure it out.
And when it comes to like this idea of fractional reserve banking, right? Like this idea that Hal Finney quote talking about Bitcoin as being a settlement layer for banks, which issue their own like paper currency backed by Bitcoin with different amounts of reserve ratios. Like in 1929, during the Great Depression, we were still on a gold standard, but the US dollar was only backed 40% by gold reserves. So in what we consider a gold standard era, there was still more outstanding US dollar fiat liabilities than there were reserve assets backing those liabilities. And this is the exact opposite, right? There's 20% outstanding liabilities or perpetual preferred products or some form of outstanding, you know, yield-bearing instrument relative to the 100% or 20% relative to the entirety of their collateral asset, which is no longer gold like it was in 1929, but Bitcoin in this case. So like, I think you would be wary if their outstanding liabilities exceeded their total reserves, but that's normal for a bank. So we're just playing in a completely different playing field. And like my thinking is, I think someday, maybe 10 years from now, there could be a world in which Strategy's preferred equity outstanding actually matches their total Bitcoin assets or some hybrid fractional reserve banking. Yeah. Like some sort of hybrid fractional reserve banking situation going on, especially if they're lending their Bitcoin or getting some sort of payment on their Bitcoin from JP Morgan or something. I don't know exactly how that works, but I think we're going to see over time higher and higher amplification ratios as the volatility comes down on Bitcoin and as more and more institutions start issuing products that are built on top of this reserve asset, Bitcoin.
Completely nailed it. As the volatility reduces and the balance sheet grows, that amplification ratio can increase, because what you're effectively doing is underwriting Bitcoin. You're underwriting your ability to pay the dividends into perpetuity. And you know what? I did a little bit of analysis on this, and maybe it'll make sense at some point to go back through this kind of calculation that I did on like, what if you just had this model and you just sold the dividends in order to pay the dividend payments and you didn't even have access to an ATM, the model still works. Like the model is still very interesting if you just did this without access to an ATM to potentially pay dividends or other capital markets activities or cash flow from your operating business. So one thing that I wanted to put this into perspective, which is just, it's just so fascinating, right? Like just a little bit ago, I talked about how Strategy traded about $1.2 trillion in 2025, which is just massive amount of volume. And the question that keeps coming to my mind is like, why is this stock so liquid? What, right? Like it has been a top 20 publicly traded equity by volume since October of 2024. Okay. It's the 215th largest publicly traded equity in the market. Yet today it was the 15th largest by volume. What's going on there? Like I've been trying to wrap my head around it. I think it's primarily because it's backed by Bitcoin, which is just this hyper liquid asset. And you've got this huge derivatives market that's built behind it. And you've got people that are hedging the Bitcoin market in the MSTR derivatives market. You've got all of these different components that are brought in here. And Adrian, I know you've got some multivariate correlation statistic analysis on this, and maybe we'll hop into that. But one thing I wanted to point out. So what I've done here is I pulled all of Strategy's perpetual preferred equities. I pulled their notional amounts, the shares outstanding, and the annual dividend amounts. So the current annual dividend is $796 million for the five perpetual preferred equities that are outstanding. Today's trading volume was $4.5 billion. Today, $4.5 billion of Strategy stock traded hands today. That's 17% of the volume today. Okay. So now what's the quarterly dividend? The quarterly dividend is $199 million. That's 4% of today's volume. What's the monthly dividend? Okay. The monthly dividend is $66 million. That's about 1.4% of today's volume. If you were to break it down by trading day, so divided by 250, I think it's right, but divided by 250 trading days in the year, that's $3.1 million of capital that they would need to raise per day. If the volume were to stay around the same, about $4.5 billion. So it's 0.07% of the daily trading volume. Okay. So like, it's hard to wrap your head around that. So I came up with an analogy. Imagine you go to a college football game and there are 10,000 people there, and you need to convince 7 of those 10,000 people to drink a beer. How many people would you have to walk by in order to get 7 beers drank? You'd probably do it in a row. You go down one row, you'd be able to convince 7 people to drink a beer. Like, that's how little this is. Like, 7 out of 10,000.
You could get it done with one guy.
You probably could. You probably could. It's probably Dan, to be honest. You can put him down. So you know, just the relativity there is just so, it's just so small. And you think of the yearly traded volume, like 1.25 trillion, you got 796 million part of 1.25 trillion. Yeah, they're probably going to figure it out. They're going to be able to find a way to pay this. And even if they had to sell the Bitcoin, like, that still works. Bitcoin trades $60 billion a day. It's the most liquid asset on the planet. It's crazy. Adrian, I'm going to kick it over to you because I know you feel strongly about this and you think about liquidity. You've been doing analysis on this. Like, what are you thinking about?
So where should I start? I don't want to speak about this in a way that's going to lose people. So let's try to use the simple analogies that you've been using. One of the things that has been a persistent kind of talking point has been the ATM is driving price, right? They issue shares and it's driving the price down. So what I did is, I've been doing this for about a year and a half now, and the analysis has kind of been built out. What I've been doing is I've been watching the ATM issuance. I've been trying to model this statistically to figure out, can I see a clear correlation between share issuance and price activity, right? Very, very simply. And to do that, the first thing I did was I just took share issuance, kind of like what you did as percentage of volume, and I wasn't seeing anything. On any given issuance, there's something between like 1 to 4% of the overall trading volume. And on the high times, so like in October and November of 2024, they went up to like 7% at certain times. But the thing that people don't understand is that the ATM is a function of volume. It is something that's market driven. It is not as if they're just going to be issuing shares when there's no demand for it, right? So it's a function of demand. So then I had to think through, well, what is actually driving price action? And to do that, I started modeling Bitcoin. I started modeling in options activity. Then I started modeling in what I like to call sector rotation. So all of the different Bitcoin miners. And then I started modeling in the ETF impact and the impact of other Bitcoin treasury companies. And long story short, there's a way that you can attribute a percentage of trading volume and activity if you have the appropriate data set and the appropriate sized data sets and over the appropriate timeframes. So essentially what I've found is that over the last year, probably more accurately over the last 14 months, the options market has actually been driving price activity just as much as Bitcoin, if not more than Bitcoin at certain times. And when I say certain times, I don't mean like a week or two. I mean for like months. So to feed into what you've been saying, why is this equity so liquid? Why is there so much trading volume? It's because people are using strategy as a way to place various bets on Bitcoin. It's become a proxy for Bitcoin, not just in like a beta play, but it's also a proxy for Bitcoin in the sense of how people are playing Bitcoin in the market. The reason why we didn't have like an alt cycle this last year is because a lot of it was sucked up by the Bitcoin treasury companies. And also a lot of that interest was sucked up by the strategy options market and the overall interest in strategy. So what we've been seeing is people that are playing strategy, and there's a strong, strong correlation between the options market activity and the price activity we've been seeing in strategy. to the tune of something like 25% of price variance can be explained just by the options market. And I modeled that out using delta exposure. I modeled that out using open interest. I modeled that out using gamma exposure. I modeled that out using put call ratios. And I also modeled it out using the spread between open interest on a weekly and monthly and quarterly basis to see if I can cleanly identify when the market was moving. And the correlations are stark. And it's not a matter of correlation here. It's a matter of attributing.
Pause there for a second. What Adrian's saying, if I were to summarize this up, is that the option market open interest had a higher correlation to the change in strategy price than ATM issuance. To the tune of option open interest is around 25% correlation, and something like the ATM issuance was like 0.15% correlation.
Yes.
Keep going.
Yeah. And to test that theory, I also modeled out ATM issuance using all of them. So I went through the 8K filings and I manually tabulated all the different ATM issuances. So that was in 2025, just in 2024 to 2023, and a little bit of issuance they did in 2022. And I modeled it all the way back to the BSE era. So the Bitcoin Standard era, what was that, August 20th, 16th, something like that, whatever it was. And I modeled it out using trading volume as a proxy for ATM. Now, why did I do that? And why did I do that first before moving into the options? Is because I need to cleanly say, is the ATM impacting price? And by impacting, that means not that it's driving price, that it can actually be seen in the data and it's having a sizable impact on the way the price is moving. The challenge with it is that I had to do it in a way that the ATM will still show up in the data. So first I had a test for that, which I was able to find that even if it was a small amount, it was still showing despite the fact that I had 50 other variables. So that tells me that I was modeling it correctly. It wasn't getting lost in noise. I was attributing everything accurately. And then on top of that, I had to say, okay, so now that I've attributed it accurately, how much price action is that actually driving? Going back to 2020, it almost disappears. It drives down all the way to zero, which makes sense. So then I went to 2022, then I went to 2023, then I went to 2024 and 2025, and that's when it started showing up in the data. And at the highest peak, so that's in October and November of 2024, It ticked up to 0.6%. So then I said to myself, well, what else is going to be pushing the price besides options market? Then I started looking at M2. Then I started looking at the federal funds rate. Then I started looking at the VIX. Long story short, everything is pushing the price on strategy more than ATM by a factor of about 7. And that's just on the federal funds rate. When you look at the options market, when you look at Bitcoin miners, when you look at Bitcoin itself, the impact of price proportionally to the ATM becomes almost laughable. It completely disappears when I start to put it on a proportional scale. So is that me saying that at no point in time can ATM ever impact price? No. What I am saying is that for this particular equity, it is too multivariate and the market is too big for ATM to be driving price in any appreciable way. And I then, to make the matters even more interesting, I said, well, how far can I push ATM in the modeling until it starts actually having an appreciable impact on price? I got it all the way up to 20%.
Get the ATM up to 20% and still like theoretically not making it. Yeah.
Using the existing history of the volume, I said, let me crank up the ATM to say, what if they were doing 20% in perpetuity? 20% in perpetuity got it up to 2%. So what we're seeing right now is unprecedented. We have an equity that has essentially become a betting ground for Bitcoin.
Yeah, right. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things here, right? Strategy's gotten absolutely hammered in 2025. They've issued more shares, but the balance sheet is stronger. And then you could think through, you look at the size of the option market, and the option market for MSDR is bigger than the option market for IBIT. And that's an interesting perspective. So you want leverage on leverage, and the market is using MSDR to hedge. Now, what that shows you is when this does turn around, it's probably going to be explosive, because it's going to flip and go the other way. They have to hedge the other direction, right? So, it just like we've seen in the past, when Bitcoin moves very quickly in a period of 10 to 20 days, MSTR is probably going to move quickly times two.
Well, the other aspect of that,
I'll take the other side of that bet.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, so yeah,
he's gonna move slower.
No, I just mean I think MSTR is going to outperform Bitcoin over the long run. I think the days of 2x MNAV, 3x MNAV, all things being equal right now, are over. Also, I don't think it's intellectually honest to say that the price of Stretch can be capped at 100 with the ATM and then turn around and say the ATM has no effect on the MSTR price.
Well, you're comparing two completely different things. The Stretch doesn't have the level of interest
in this conversation.
Well, Stretch doesn't have the level of interest, and Stretch doesn't have the level of variables impacting the price. If all things being equal, you would be saying that you have the Stretch options market, which is like almost non-existent, and then you have the issuance of shares. On the flip side, with MSTR, you have the options market, you have the issuance of shares, you have the correlation to Bitcoin, you have the impact that's coming from all of the Bitcoin miners, you have the impact that's coming from sector rotation, you have the impact that's coming from all of the other Bitcoin treasury companies. You also have the fact that there's all kinds of leverage plays on top of MSTR. Then you have the fact that there's options plays on top of it that are income generating. There are too many factors for one thing to be driving the price. So it's not a matter of intellectual honesty, it's a matter of scale and impact. And the fact of the matter is, if they were to issue equity on Stretch, could they drive the price down? Yes, but that's specifically why I said, in the case of this equity, because of all of the multivariate factors that come into play, you cannot say that any one thing has been driving price. It's a matter of attribution, it's a matter of impact. So until someone actually sits down and does what I did, there's a lot missing.
I like Dan's point. I mean, it does make sense. It's like, okay, it's hard to say that the ATM is invisible over here, but it's not over here. But on the Stretch side, I think there's a couple of other
Can we pause on that?
It's not invisible. The fact is, I modeled it against 50 different factors, and it still showed up.
Well, let's pause on liquidity.
I'm exaggerating when I say invisible. Go ahead.
Let's talk liquidity for a second. You're talking about a company that trades a market, right? It's got a $60 billion market cap, and it's trading $4.5 billion a day versus something that's trading $76 million a day. Right? Like, if you're going to ATM something that's trading $76 million a day, yeah, you're going to see it.
It's a matter of scale.
I think
it's two different things.
33% of it, right? Like,
it's two different things. Like, Grant, my last point of that is, I don't think ATM, like when I say I think ATM has an impact, I don't mean if ATM hadn't been used, it wouldn't have gone. I think for some reason, something with the press happened such that Strategy was bound to go to book value at the end of this 4-year cycle. There was some sort of magnet to book value. I don't think it was necessarily the ATM. I'm not saying the recent price movement was a result of the ATM even, but I am saying that we got to call a spade a spade. If you believe ATM or share issuance is in fact a price suppressor, then you could say on MSTR, while it may not be the only price suppressor or may not even be the driving price suppressor over the past 40 months, you can't say it's not a fundamental price suppressor when it is used in that way on other equities.
You absolutely can, though. That's what I'm trying to say to you. It's a matter of you cannot simply say that one factor is driving price.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it can. Yeah. It is a price suppressing mechanism. I didn't say
there's more liquidity.
But the thing is, also on the flip side, and ATM was positively correlated with price at the end of the year in October, November 2024. It was actually positively correlated with price. So what I'm trying to frame here is, it's not about is it pushing the price down or is it pushing the price up. It's a matter of, can we see it in the data, which I can, and can we then say what impact is it having on price? If you're making the assumption that it's price suppressive, I think that comes from your viewpoint, which may or may not be valid. All I'm saying is the ATM is a function of the market. It is not a driver of the market.
You're making the ATM is a function of the market? Like, I would disagree with that, considering it's a function of the issuing corporation decides to issue the ATM, yeah. Right?
Yeah, but it is a term.
It's a function of the volume. It's probably
a function of the volume, and the volume is a function of the market.
So,
yeah, but let me chime in here for a second. So, and I'm going to switch to a different topic, and we have good news about this, and I think this will bring this to light. Look, a year ago, 14 months, I'll say December of 2024, we were all hoping a couple things would happen. We were hoping triple Q inclusion, and we were hoping S&P 500 inclusion. Okay. And we all believe that if you get included into an index, there'll be passive buying, the stock price goes up. All agree to that, right? Now we apply the symmetry test. You can use the symmetry test or anything. If you get removed from an index, if you believe it goes up, if you get into it, exclusion on the way out, your stock price goes down. So then we had FUD about MSCI saying, oh, they're going to get removed from it. The stock sells off because there's front end loading to say, oh God, if they're going to remove out, let's sell it before it drops. That's exactly what we saw. That's a symmetry test. Assuming that if something leads to something, it goes up. If the opposite of that happens, then it would go down. That's what Dan is saying. Whatever the data says, we could see that in the real world, that's what happened. And what did we get yesterday? MSCI said we're not taking them out. And then what happens yesterday? It's the stock price shoots up. And so that confirms the symmetry test. So whatever you want to say about the data, the reality is the stock price mirrored exactly what happened there.
That doesn't make any sense.
It makes complete sense. And Adrian, I'm going to say this, because I said this one time before and we can move on. What's different about a stock than with Bitcoin? This is a very, very important part about this. And I've said this before. With a stock, there's one CUSIP. You cannot tell the age of the share that's being traded for daily volume. Whereas with Bitcoin, you hear it all the time. OG moved to Bitcoin that never moved from 2011. Oh my God, he's dumping because for whatever, he knows something and he's selling it. Even though the Bitcoin just moved, not sold. So with Bitcoin, you know the age of the coin that actually moves. And then the specific metric for a long-term holder on Bitcoin is 155 days. If you hold a Bitcoin for more than 155 days, you're considered a long-term holder. Now, if you live in America and you pay taxes, you're a long-term holder if it goes over 365 days. But people are like, well, we don't give a crap about taxes. But with a CUSIP, with a stock, you do not know the age in a given volume if it's a net new stock that's being issued through ATM or if it's old stocks that are being traded. Do you agree that is true?
Two different things.
Then we'll just agree to disagree and move on.
Look, I think everybody's partly right here. I mean, if there's more shares trading hands, like there's a larger pool of liquidity. I think there is a impact on the stock price, but it is a likely a very, very small impact on the stock price. There are other things. The point here, right, it all comes back to volume. Like, why are people holding this stock? Like, why is it trading $4.5 billion a day, right? So, Dan, to your point a little bit, like STRC, why do people hold STRC? They hold it for the interest rate. Like, the reason it trades the way it trades is because of the interest rate. Like, if it goes too high and people don't like the risk, they sell it because of the interest rate. Now, why do people buy MSTR? It is the accrual of all of the excess volatility of all the preferred equity instruments that they've issued. So as they are issuing more of these preferred equities, it's accruing like excess volatility. It's like that's this amplified component, right? It's like getting more and more amplified. It's accruing all this excess volatility. So it would make sense that it is the volatility dampener, because if you need a pool of vol, like where do you go? You go to the place with all the vol. It's got all
totally
of it.
Agree. Yeah.
It's got all the vol, and all of the excess vol is shoving over there. So I think everybody's right to some regard, right? Like you add 1% more shares, like the pool is bigger. But
do we all get a trophy?
Yeah, I think everybody gets gold star, right? We'll make it right. True North gold star.
Thing with it is that the reason why I want to be very specific with what I'm saying. It's impacting the price and driving the price are not the same thing. I think we need to differentiate that, right?
Yeah.
Then there's also the fact of that if I was doing this modeling and I wasn't seeing the ATM and the data at all, that tells me I'm doing something wrong. So the fact that it's still showing up after all these other factors are accounted for tells me that the model is correct. And I've spot checked this with so many different people at this point, it's kind of ridiculous. I'm saying that to say this. It is too simplistic to then say, because you're simply issuing more shares, that's having suppressive issue on impact on price because of all the other factors that are taking place.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
when it comes to what's pushing the price, I think people are blaming the road for the direction of the traffic. What's been pushing price down is the fact that the market is telling us very clearly they do not believe in this model, whether we believe in it or not.
I think that's a good point. Go ahead, Mason.
I think this is the more interesting conversation is what does strategy embody? Like what does MSTR embody? Right. And I think it's very multi-dimensional. I was talking to Dan and I was like, let's say you're bearish on QQQ, right? You think AI is in a bubble and you want to express that. And like maybe you have like a more traditional framework and you think Bitcoin is just, you know, NASDAQ beta, right? It's just it's going to be more volatile than the NASDAQ. And then, you know, strategy is levered Bitcoin, right? Why would you not short strategy if you think, you know, that's the position you have, especially at like, let's say they're at 2M NAV, and you also fundamentally disagree with that, right? And I think also it being at 2M NAV, that could also be an expression of, you know, short animal spirits, right? You think the market's too riled up, everyone's too bullish, and you think it's going back to one. And I think that's maybe partially what we saw in you know, Q2 to Q4 or until present. So, but strategy, like, but on the flip side, you could take the exact opposite expression and think, you know, strategy could be whatever you want for whoever, and that's what makes it so amazing.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants what they like to change. So the people who loved strategy and they were doing convertible bond deals, when they switch to something new, it's like your favorite band that changes their sound and you're just mad and like, oh, they're doing something different now. But, you know, the preferreds, as far as I'm concerned, they're more creative than the convertible bond deals.
Bingo.
And they are in their infancy stages. And, you know, just like AI is never going to be this bad, it's only getting better. The preferreds are only going to get more liquid and they're going to be more mature and they're going to be more efficient into it. Well, I'm going to call it infinity, but for my lifetime. So, you know, your favorite band got better. They're better musicians and that's, you know, they're going to have a new set of fans. Really. The old fans are going to stop showing up and the new fans are going to arrive.
You absolutely nailed exactly where I was going with this. Right. Dan, you brought up this gravity back to one MNAV. In my opinion, as like viewing risk here, as the MNAV drifts higher, if it does, I personally think it will. And I think when Bitcoin moves, it's going to drift higher. The risk of shorting it back down to one MNAV, in my opinion, gets higher. And the reason I say that, right, is a lot of people disagreed with the pref-only model. Right. Like what happened in this last year? There was a lot of disagreement with the pref model. I mean, Mike, you hated it. Dan, you hated it. You're like MSTR comments broke. And now you're like kind of long here with the pref model. Right. There was a lot of confusion. How do you pay the dividends? Didn't have dollars. They issued six of these things. The price of Bitcoin went down. There was a lot of things going against it. Now, as we progress into year one and year two and year three, and you start to build a track record of these things and they start to grow, the perception of this model is going to change and those tools get more valuable and valuable in the toolkit. So as the liquidity in those things build, you're going to start to be able to issue a little bit more of that to give you more amplification on the common stock when you need it. So, and I think this is a perfect time to talk through this. I'm sharing my screen here. Let's see if we can add it in there. So, okay. What's happened in the last year? Okay, this is from January 1st, 2025 to January 1st, 2026. So this behind this, you see the price of Bitcoin. So you see the purple line is the price of Bitcoin over the last year, right? It closed down, what, 5.17% year over year. Every single white vertical line here is an issuance of digital credit in the last year. So you got Strike happened in the end of January, Strife in March, Stride in June, Stretch in July, SATA and Stream in November. What you'll notice here is four out of the five preferred equities were issued when the Bitcoin price was higher than what the year closed at. Okay, that's interesting. I think that's really helpful to understand. Like a lot of, there's been so much FUD in the last, like, I don't know, 2 months from just horrible takes saying that there's no demand for these instruments. Like, okay, well, they raised $8 billion last year doing this, and it equates to about $18 million a day if you break it down on a per day basis. But yeah, tell me there's no demand. So why do I bring this up? So here's every instrument, digital credit instrument that was launched in the last year. Here's the Bitcoin price at which those instruments were launched at, right? So Strike was launched at 104,000. Stride was 101,000. Stretch is 117,000. You look at the notional outstanding. Then I take the percentage of total of each of these instruments relative to the notional outstanding. 84% of the prefs that were issued in 2025 were issued with a Bitcoin price greater than $100,000. And we're sitting at Bitcoin at $91,000. The only one that the underlying balance sheet has grown from a Bitcoin perspective since issuance is STRF. The Bitcoin price is up 8% from when STRF was launched. So not a surprise that honestly, that Strife is trading, you know, slightly above par. Kind of makes sense. The underlying collateral value went up. Now, when people are saying that there's no demand on this stuff, like I got to say, you got to be crazy. They've raised hundreds of millions of dollars of additional pref while the what happened, right? Like the underlying value of the collateral held on the balance sheet or the capital held on the balance sheet is going to be improving drastically, which de-risks all of these instruments and makes the relative risk profile look better and better and better, which should boost liquidity, makes the common stock look significantly better. As they get more of this instrument in, they're adding more Bitcoin capital to the underlying balance sheet. Amplification rises. Like that's why, you know, when you're thinking about like, okay, we're in year one of digital credit. Last year was year zero. It was born last year. We're at the beginning. We're at the beginning here from when all of these things were issued. And all technically, from the Bitcoin price perspective, all of them are technically underwater from when they were IPO'd. So I'm not surprised.
$8 billion when Bitcoin was uncooperative.
Yes. They raised $8 billion of this stuff when Bitcoin was uncooperative. I think that was a great way to say it. Absolutely. So, you know, when you look at this, the fact that Stretch is trading what at $100, they increased the interest rate from 10, what is it, 9 to 11, but Stretch is trading at $100, and today it traded, I don't know, $76 million. If they took 33% of the volume, which is what they took back in November when Stretch hit par, you're talking about them raising $25 million in a day. Now, that's interesting. That's an interesting story. So I don't know. What do you guys think about this? To me, if Bitcoin runs from here, like this is a good position to be in. Like Dan, you like the common right now, right? You're getting in near NAV.
Yeah, it's just like
excess volatility here.
Exactly. It's it's hard to tell if the MNAV is going to expand or not. If you get in at book value, it expands your gravy. If this thing trades a book, you're also gravy if you think Bitcoin's going out.
So if you're a Bitcoin bull.
I get questions about Stretch daily. The level of interest in it is kind of crazy. Of all the preferreds, that's attracting the most attention from what I can see.
Yeah,
I think so too. Like this idea of it's really scary with like bonds, right? Like so you're telling me interest rates change and I could lose 20%. Like you're levered on interest rates. So the idea of a long dated bond, and obviously these are perpetual preferred products, but you can use the Macaulay duration formula to figure out kind of how these things will behave based on changes in the interest rate environment. And not right now, they're just trading based on credit spreads and the seasoning of strategies and issuer. So it doesn't really matter the long-term interest rate because the credit spread's so high. Point being is no one wants to take principal risk. They want to have their money. They want to get yield. And they don't care if the yield's a little bit lower here or there. Like they don't care if the Stretch yield's lower than Stride. They just want to make sure they have $100 when they want to pull it out. And I think principal risk is like the main thing. And that's why, you know, Saylor has said Stretch is the killer product, the killer app. For those reasons, you know, they've been able to stabilize. So what do you guys think? I have a question in terms of, so obviously we think the ATM was hit today as Stretch was bumping up against 100. I've heard that, you know, the strategy teams, you know, they've been very aggressive with their ATM issuance at 100. But then on top of that, do you think they will continue to raise the dividend rate? So the ex-dividend date, you have to have Stretch in your account, as I understand it. So you have to be holding 15th. It on the morning of the 15th, but you have you actually have to have bought it before the 14th because there's an ex-dividend date and there's ex-dividend date and then a record date. The ex-dividend date's the 14th. So if you buy on the 14th, you don't get the dividend. You have to buy before the 14th to qualify for your dividend. You have to be holding before the ex-dividend date, and then you have to market has to open, and you have to be holding it on the record date. That's the ex-dividend date is a broker rule. The record date is a strategy rule. So I think the key is the 13th falls on, I think, Monday, correct? Right? So
yeah, I think Friday's it's I think Tuesday.
Tuesday. So I think a lot of this, we're seeing this on a monthly basis. As a dividend date approaches, the market starts to pile in and be like, let me clip this coupon. Then we see the price retrace on the ex-dividend date as people sell because they've qualified for the dividend. And so I think over time, this will become a more mature market and we're going to see the ex-dividend date fall by the same percentage as the payout. And it's starting to trade like a real kind of fixed income market. I think it's going to be pretty interesting moving forward, see how that trades.
You hit the nail on the head, because if you only had to hold it for 3 days and you get the dividend and you feel like you have the opportunity to go earn, you know, more money elsewhere, you're holding it up until that point in time. And I think one thing that's interesting, if you think about this as a short duration instrument, I think up until the 13th, maybe the 14th, Dan, we probably see, unless something drastically changes with Bitcoin, we probably see Stretch continue to trade right at 100, near
1,000%. 1,000%. Totally agree.
And after the ex dividend date, we probably see it drop a little bit. And I think that the amount that it drops will probably start to decrease a little bit more and more over time as that pool of liquidity becomes deeper and deeper and there's more confidence in this instrument. And one thing I wanted to bring up and share with some people, just because this is like understanding how this was issued, I think is an important if you care about this and you think there's no demand, understanding how this was issued is really important. Okay. So they raised $2.5 billion of this stuff in July. They went out to market. They went to a bunch of banks and they told the banks like, hey, we want to issue this cool variable instrument. All the banks were like heads exploding because they've never seen anything like it before. And you get all these people that were interested in taking a speculative bet on this new instrument being created. They're like, okay, this is a similar flavor to STRK and STRF that you've launched. And sure, I'll buy it. And so you've got actually a significant amount of interest, right? So how this works is all of the bankers and you get retail people and they give you an indication of interest. And they'll tell you exactly how much they're interested in buying and at what price. And some people will tell you like, hey, at this price, I'll give you 100 million. Let's just say at 90 and 9%, I'll give you 100 million. But if you gave me a discount at 80, and 9%. I'll give you 250 million. So you build like what's an order book. And so what they ended up landing on was, I think it was $9 per share on par, priced at a discount of $90. So everybody, that $2.5 billion of interest, when they first bought this, they bought in at $90. So as it began to trade up to 100, not only do they get paid the yield, they also get the option of principal appreciation. So it's got the potential to go up 11%, and it's paying you 9%. So you get a double whammy, you win twice. Now, the reason I bring that up is because in the IPO, just like any other IPO, there are people that don't give a shit about the yield or anything else. They just know that they're getting an opportunity to buy something at a discount, and the company is going to make this thing go to 100. They're going to do everything in their power to go to 100. So you've got all of these, you know, institutions that are like, yeah, look, I'll give you all this capital. I'm going to buy it at 90 and I'm going to sell it when it goes to 100. I don't care. Maybe I'll take, you know, maybe I'll clip a couple months of coupons as the liquidity builds in this thing, and I can kind of drip shares out into the market. So what that effectively is an overhang. Like, I think people don't really understand that. Like, that is an overhang on the stock for the people that don't want the yield, don't care about the yield. They're waiting until the principal appreciates, and they're just dripping shares out because they're like, great, I got another 10%. I got another 10%. And they've held this instrument, what, for 6 months, and they got 10% because they bought it at 90 and they've been selling it at 100. So there's an overhang on this stuff. And once that overhang is gone and these shares are in the hands of people that want the yield, the amount of volume and their ability to pull capital in the door on this thing is going to be insane. This is like a pipe deal. Like, everybody's had the boogeyman of the pipe. Like, this is effectively, you can think of it like a pipe deal or like any other IPO arbitrage opportunity. And that is fundamental in understanding how this works. I think we're probably getting close to a lot of those shares being turned over and in different hands for the people that, you know, didn't want to be in this instrument long term.
So Jeff, let me reconstruct what you're saying. Saylor decides to do a digital credit product. So what he does is he calls up a book runner, calls up his investment bank and says, look, I came up with digital credit. It's called Strike, Stretch, whatever these instruments are, and shows them the prospectus and says, look, I'm going to sell. I want to know what your appetite is for this, and it pays this yield. And they read it, they agree to it, and they say, fine. So what they do is, because it's not available, and the brokerage houses can come to you and say, hey, do you want to buy this? And so you sign up on your brokerage house. Yes, I want to buy this on the first day. And they gauge that amount of interest. So let's say they want to raise $1 billion, but they find out that there's only going to be $200 million worth of retail coming in and buying it. So what the institutions do is they buy the full $2 billion, right? Saylor will say sometimes there's a green shoe and it's oversubscribed. We've been talking about this for years. The green shoes are not new. Same thing with an MSTR ATM. He'll do that. So the brokerage, what happens is the investment bank and the book runner give Saylor $1 billion. Saylor goes and buys $1 billion worth of Bitcoin and he announces the orange dot, right? And you're like, okay. Now they gave him $1 billion. And what do? They're sitting on $1 billion worth of these shares. Now they have $200 million for people that want IPOs. They give it to the $200 million. Now there's $800 million left out over. The casual observer on X, you know where I'm going, is, oh, then they just dump the other $800 million in a market order when the market opens and crash the price and short it. That is exactly what has not happened. What Jeff is saying here, Jeff, if I understand what you're saying and reconstructing it, they then drip those shares out to the market over the course of days, weeks, and months to keep the price relatively stable, because they don't want to lose the money that they gave to Saylor to go buy the magical Bitcoins.
You bingo.
Are we all in agreement that that's the way an ATM and this works?
Absolutely. And what an awesome deal for the bankers, right? Like, or the people that purchased in the IPO, right?
Wait, let me give the good news. Why would a banker do this? The banker gets paid a fee. So the, and you look, and every time they do this, it lists the line item. This is the fee. The banker gets a fee. What the banker also has, and this is not nefarious, is nobody knows how much of the shares the banker has. Nobody, the banker knows, but we don't know. And we don't know how many people bought the IPO. Now, let's assume that the IPO was oversubscribed. So there's $1.2 billion worth of retail, and the bank gave Saylor $1 billion. You're like, oh, what happens in that case, Green? Oh, well, that's really easy. What does the bank do? Not only do they keep their fee, they slowly issue out those shares in the market to capture the spread. They're like, oh, that's manipulation. No, that's the way you would do it. I just said, if you had all of this, would you dump the shares on day one at the open with a market order?
No.
Never. You distribute it out slowly. I don't know why people miss this. We've been talking about this for a year and a half.
The coolest part for the people that were holding it, or like that invested in the IPO, is like, even if you didn't care about it, right? You look at a company like Strategy, you're like, they're at least going to pay the dividend for a year. So you're like, I've got a year to drip this out. If I think the company's going to actively manage it to 100, I'm like, cool, I can make 11% watching you go from 90 to 100. And I get paid while I'm holding it. I get paid every month while I'm holding it. Like, it's just a fantastic deal. So anyway, I think we're close. We're probably pretty close to getting rid of the overhang that's on top of that. And then you're starting, you'll probably start to see people that are holding these instruments a little bit more long-term, whether that be, you know, pension funds, insurance companies.
So. Yeah. So I'm going to add an extra word in here. One of the words that you'll see come up sometimes is equilibrium. What happens is, or stabilize over time. So as the shares get into the market, as the market becomes more comfortable with it, they're like, oh, it's stabilized, or now it's in equilibrium. And that's what you're seeing in Stretch. The range for that is going to be somewhere between 98 and 100 bucks. But the goal is to keep it between 99 and 100. Maybe they could peg the vol less. I think Saylor said in the last call, it's at 5, he can get the 3%. And the goal is to get to 1%. But
Dan's going to take it even lower.
Dan's going to take it lower because what's going to happen is they're going to build on top of it, and it's going to be, there'll be a perpetual bid on it from multiple areas, right? So this is where the market's going. But guys, by the way, people think the prefs are going after the bond market, right? Oh, the prefs are going after the bond market. Stretch is going after the money market funds, right? And Saylor has talked about this in Miami specifically, and multiple places, most recently in Miami. But the money market funds is $7 trillion. And think about that. Well, if it's liquid, right, then think about this. If your money market fund pays, I don't know, what does a money market fund pay? 1%, right? And if you're a brokerage house, you're like, we'll give people 6%. We'll keep 5% for ourselves. The bank or the brokerage house would make a 5% spread. And I know this because I posted this back in Miami and I tagged Saylor in it. I'm like, did I get it right? And he's like, yep. So that's exactly what we're trying to do here. They're going to keep that spread. So the first three, most of the prefs are the bond market, but Stretch is going after the money market fund. And that's $7 trillion.
The craziest part is it's both, right? Imagine your bond portfolio with liquid bonds that are beating everything else. Like that's the craziest part. It's both. It beats everything. It beats every bond out there from every facet. Like, less risky. It's less volatile. It's more liquid. Like every single facet out there. And maybe we'll get into the bond of the week.
I want to wrap this up with two things. I go first. I think probably one of the biggest problems with TradFi or investment banks looking at it is the first thing is that they don't understand it. And the second thing is it's too good to be true. They're just like, no, it's too good to be true. It's going to implode. It's too good to be true. That's the reason why Saylor invented the green dots and acquired cash. Because somebody's like, can you ensure that this is going to get paid? And we're like, yeah, what's the current metrics on that? We can pull it up.
Yeah, it's 2.5 years. They've got 2.5 years.
It's like 34 months or something. On what do you call it? On the cash balance, and what is it, 70 something years on the Bitcoin
it's,
to pay the
it's insane. It's like crazy overcapitalized.
Right. And I want to call one last thing. We can move on.
All right. You've had like five last things, Green. Come on.
But no, I'm known for that. I'm really known for that. Look, Matt Cole said something, and you said this about goodwill. If software is made free by AI, Matt Cole said this, then the goodwill for software pretty much goes to zero.
Zero.
Okay. He said that. And I wrote, that is awesome and horrifying at the same time. So think about this. So when you're going to talk about the bad bonds that are doing, the transparency on strategy, the dashboard showing you in real time what it is. But if other companies had to show real time value of their software, and specifically relative to AI coming in, oh my God, if I was a CEO, I'd be like, of a software company right now, I would have a crisis meeting right now and say, how are we going to make sure that some other company using AI doesn't offer the same functionality for 1/100th of the price?
Yeah.
I would be scared about that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mason. You're going to jump in.
I think what we're going to see over the next few years is, or maybe next decade, is massive disruption. And I think what Bitcoin and digital credit are, it's kind of safe harbor for both parts of a traditional portfolio, right? If you're looking at 60-40. Yeah, like digital credit is obviously better than any single bond out there, any single money market. And realistically, it's not that hard to figure out. Like, you have to accept Bitcoin as kind of a thing that is going to be here. And then you just show them the financials. Like, Jeff, you can pull that up. It's like, if anybody with any kind of financial literacy who's managing capital can and really internalize what that means, then it's not hard to figure out, right? So I think digital credit will be safe harbor for the bonds, which are going to increasingly be disrupted. And then it's the same thing for the equity side, right? Like, if I think a pretty popular trade right now is going short software as service, long hardware. Right? I think ultimately everything gets disrupted, and that's why you have Bitcoin. So I think the really interesting conversation here is, what does adoption look like? What is the time frame for a catalyst? Because we know what we've got, right? But how does that play out? And I think we'll be here watching in the meantime.
Yeah, 100%.
So I'm going to summarize what Mason said. What he said is short software, long hardware. What that means is that one of the reasons why NVIDIA trades so well, and people are like, oh, well, some other company will come out with better hardware than NVIDIA. NVIDIA has a software stack on top of it called CUDA, C-U-D-A. And so it's not only do you have to come up with better hardware, but everybody that's wrote the AI apps that run on top of NVIDIA needs to have the software that uses it. In the case of NVIDIA, it's embedded, right? You have to use their software with their hardware. Now, what you're also saying, Mason, the meta message here is, you know, Microsoft is a software play and use any hardware. The hardware had no value. The bigger play here is Apple. What do? Apple, you buy the computer, it can only run Apple software. And so, meaning the operating system. So I think this is where the market's going. How is this related to strategy? Strategy is the biggest issuer of prefs, full stop, right? Jeff, is there any company that has issued more prefs than Strategy?
No, no way. They like set records with all the IPOs. They've set records with the trading volume. They've set records with, they're the first company to put a ATM on top of a preferred equity, which is super novel. I think everybody really overlooks like how crazy novel that is. Like, they can issue debt like capital as equity any day of the week. Like, that is that is such a valuable tool that is commonly overlooked.
And right. It's the only way to create Stretch. It's the only way. The only way Stretch was able to be created was because of the ATM on top of the preferreds.
Right. Bingo. And the other part with Stretch was the largest IPO of the whole year, correct?
Yeah. I think one came out at the end, but I think you're right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's close.
Okay, well, okay. It's like close.
Preferred equity, largest ATM, largest IPO of the year. It's crazy.
Right. So I think we're looking at, you know, if we want to be mad at something, be mad at Bitcoin. Be mad at forever, whatever reason the price went down. We didn't get any freaking help from Bitcoin. That's,
I mean, and that's with strategy buying 250,000.
Right. I like when I hear something, oh, we don't like Saylor, what he's doing, because he's going to make the market, he'll make the market worse. I'll be like, you know what, dude? If strategy didn't buy 250,000 Bitcoins, I don't even want to talk about what the price of Bitcoin would be, because I'll tell you right now, it'd be lower.
It'd be way lower. If the ETFs weren't there, if the derivatives market wasn't so huge.
If the spot Bitcoin ETFs were and they weren't doing this, it would be lower.
On this point, I think we should talk about MSCI briefly, because MSCI came out and they had reversed their stance, and now they're allowing companies with digital assets greater than 50% of their treasury to stay within the index funds. And so a couple of things that are really interesting here. They came out with this note on, it was October 10th, the day of the flash crash. Companies with greater than 50% of their digital assets, they're considering removing them from all of the index funds. And it created this huge period. Up until January 15th, they were going to make their decision. And so they had almost an entire quarter to figure out what they wanted to do with this. Well, that creates uncertainty for the entire market. Everywhere. It creates uncertainty on all of the digital asset treasury companies, creates uncertainty on Bitcoin, on top of having like four-year cycle bros YOLOing out of this thing. And then you've got uncertainty on pref models, and you've got all this stuff happening. And then fast forward to a couple of days ago, Morgan Stanley comes out with a Bitcoin ETF. That's interesting. MSCI used to be owned by Morgan Stanley, but they were divested in 2007. That's interesting. Just a lot of, you know, things that are, when you plug them together and you look at this timeline, like if you wanted to increase and scare the market and get some increased Bitcoin exposure, that's a pretty good way to do it, to create some uncertainty within the market of the largest publicly continuous buyer of the stuff. And then you've got potentially coordinated FUD with JP Morgan, that like Walter Bloomberg account. It was just like heinous, ridiculous takes in all of Q4, but really it was uncertainty from quite a few things.
Can I speak on that?
100%.
That Walter Bloomberg thing. I was at the Naples family office that Saylor spoke at, and he was on stage straight face. Bitcoin's going to 10K in the next 3 months. I'm like, you know that meme? Are you sure about that? You know, exactly. And so, but what's so interesting is I saw a post today from him. It seems like, and so on Kalshi, Bitcoin reclaiming 100K just hit 40% this month, which is very high. Like if you price that as an option, that, you know, that's pretty high. Options market's getting really expensive, both for MSTR and Bitcoin. Something's changed. Long-term holders obviously have stopped selling. Like some sort of momentum has shifted. But my point being is Walter Bloomberg came out with a post. It wasn't Walter Bloomberg. It's the other guy, Mike McGlone. Excuse me. Mike McGlone did the speech at Naples. He came out with a post today and said, there may be a reason, a scenario in which Bitcoin doesn't go down to 10K during 2026. I'm like, oh, really? And he says, because of reduced volatility in the equities market and for some other nonsense reason. So he's pretty much saying the equities market may have a good year. And there's so many reasons why the equities market will probably have a good year. Credit spreads are extremely tight on all the junk bonds. Bitcoin is performing really well, not hitting all the resistance levels or whatever shelf falling off TA lines that people were saying it was going to hit. And I think it's because the institutions are stepping in and buying, much like they front ran the end of the four-year cycle, they're front running the end of the bear market, right? Essentially our four-year cycle, we hit 126K 4 months early. And I think institutions will do the same thing, and they'll start buying on the way down as they get their entry prices months in advance of when the historic bear market would end, which is in the second half of 2026. So, like, if you're going to buy something, if you like it at 50,000, you're a buyer at 65,000. Any smart investors probably kind of thinking that way, especially if you believe it's going to a million plus over a long period of time.
Yep.
Hold
on, Mason. I gotta pause. I've got to plug this. We've got a short commercial break, kind of. We have True North Vegas. This is happening in partnership with Strategy World here in February at Strategy World. I believe it is February 23rd through February 26th, the Strategy World. Our event is going to be on the 23rd. It's going to be a great time. There's 150 tickets in total that will be sold. So far, we've already sold 67. 44% of the tickets have been sold. And once they're all gone, they're all gone. So if you want to come out, come have a very unique, interactive experience, come talk with us, hang out. The tickets will get you access to, we'll have a happy hour at a cool location afterwards. There's about 4 hours of content. This content will be interactive. And we'll do a little bit of presentations, a little bit of conversations, and probably some rotation of topics. You'll get a chance to meet and hang out with everybody. And it will be a great time. It'll be slightly elevated from what we did last year. And I'm sure we'll have a couple of guests from some of the Bitcoin companies swing by. So please take a peek at it. Come hang out with us. We'd love to meet anybody that's interested in this. And if you're interested in hearing like what's going on in the strategy world, there's an entire Bitcoin for Corporations track at Strategy World for 3 days in a row. So you can hear this from the horse's mouth, from different banking institutions, different treasury companies, and you can really interact and network with all of these people in a very small group of people. So it's a fantastic event. It's going to be bigger and badder than last year, and really looking forward to it. Anybody else have anything to add?
Yeah, you know, I'll chime in one thing. If look, meeting us is great. What I'll tell you is that Michael Saylor is accessible. If you go to an event where he is, especially if you go to this event, there's a really good chance that if you look for him, you could find him, meet him, and talk to him. And so if you want to meet the guy yourself, I would suggest you go to the event and you go and talk to him. That, I mean, we met and spoke to him many times in Orlando last year. And I met him previously the year before that, 2 years ago, was the first time I met him in person. And I talked to him multiple times over multiple days that I was there. So I suggest that everybody come, not just to meet us, so you can meet him also. And the rest of the executive team, they were all there also.
It's Andrew Kang, it's Sharice, it's CJ, right. It's Charlie, it's everybody on the strategy team will be there. And if you want to talk the Bitcoin treasury strategy and you want to hear it from the people that are working, there's likely going to be bankers there. There's likely going to be lawyers there. If you want to talk to these people that are actually operating behind the scenes, it's not the Bitcoin, you know, the big Bitcoin conference in April. It's this event. It's the Strategy World event. I think last year there were like 400 people there, 400, 500 people at the Strategy World event. Everybody was incredibly accessible. So
yeah, right. I'm not saying anything is wrong with the Bitcoin event. The problem with the Bitcoin event trying to meet Saylor is there's 25,000 people there. So the security was tight because there's 25,000 people. With these events, because they're much, much smaller, you can get there, meet him, and it's great.
Yep. Okay. Back to you, Mason. Sorry, I had to interrupt.
Yeah, I want to get into Dan's macro slides, but maybe one way to lead up to this is I think the market may soon start to appreciate the fact that Bitcoin has less regulatory risk than a lot of individual companies or sectors. And I think we're seeing this even today, right? You had two pretty substantial kind of sweeping announcements from Trump, which, you know, may or may not come into effect. One was corporations won't be able to buy, you know, single family homes. And the other was that defense companies can't buy back stock or pay their CEOs or executives more than $5 million, right? I don't know if there's any precedent for this, but defense stocks went down, Blackstone went down, right? And what, you know, the fact that there was this response to me just indicates that the executive branch or government in general can cause, you know, substantial volatility. Whereas with Bitcoin, sure, it can have negative price action from regulatory actions, right? But what I think we've seen is adoption.
Mason, your audio is horrible. Can you try jumping off and jumping back on? Yeah.
All right.
While Mason does that, I think what he's getting at is basically the president can move markets with a single tweet, move the real estate market today, move the defense stock market, and then, you know, kind of reversed course and said, oh, military spending is going to go from $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion. And then all of a sudden, what was it, Lockheed Martin closed up on the day after just this crazy volatility. Well, try it again, Mason.
You guys hear me?
That's better.
Loud and clear.
All right. I don't know how much you got, but essentially we're seeing increased volatility from regulatory risk. And I think in the world that we're going into, Bitcoin is a safe harbor. And hopefully the market will begin to appreciate that. And it will be events such as what we saw today, which will be a catalyst for viewing Bitcoin as, you know, more of a risk off asset than it is right now, which is a risk on Brazilian Wi-Fi.
That's a great comment.
Just got the Brazilian Wi-Fi.
No, and yeah. and Mason and I were talking about this the other night, and I think it's super spot on, because part of Saylor's whole talk track and why it's also the underpinning for why strategy is applying leverage to the Bitcoin is if you believe Bitcoin is going up 30 ARR and it's risk-free, then you want to apply leverage and you can get higher returns. You're upping your risk on an asset that has no risk, right? If you believe Bitcoin has no risk, but it has volatility, then by applying leverage, you're introducing risk onto the asset, which is an interesting way to look at it. And yes. So I think the difference in the market, or the way the market's not understanding Bitcoin, is I think it's overestimating the risk in Bitcoin. And if it truly does become this sort of risk-free, pristine capital asset, then, you know, equities won't look as enticing. But that's old news. We've talked about that before.
Yeah, it's this risk is mispriced, right? Equity risk is mispriced. All of these other things are trading at, you know, 30, 50 XPE multiples, 100 XPE multiples. And now you've got Bitcoin, which universally trades at 1 XPE every day. Now you've got companies that are trading and applying leverage on top of it that are now trading at like net asset value. Like what is a digital credit company vehicle worth? Like what is the vehicle that Strategy has created? Like what is that worth? Probably more than NAV. Probably a lot more than NAV. Like what would somebody be willing to pay for this vehicle? What do you think Strategy would be willing to pay to sell the vehicle? I don't think there's a number.
There has to be a buyer.
Right now, there's no buyer. I just don't think that there's a number, right? That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. So look, I'll give something interesting. You know, why would somebody buy the MSTR common stock? So Strategy is the operating company, and they offer all these different products. We've already talked about on the prefs, MSTR common. So what happens is if the prefs are mostly designed to have eclipse some form of the volatility in order to pay you a yield. That's exactly what Saylor's all the time in the slide that talks about, hey, we have oil, and then we break it down into different fuels and different purposes as we distill it down. So in this case,
They don't clip the volatility though. Clipping the volatility would be like selling calls to pay the dividends. They're not doing that.
Grain and transferring. I think grain, you're transferring.
Yeah.
I get what
you're saying. I just want to, that's a distinction that I think is important to mention. Like they're not clipping the volatility. They're not taking the volatility off their balance sheet. They're actually throwing more volatility into the balance sheet, and they're underwriting the risk of the instrument.
So Jeff, I agree with what you're saying. Because they add more Bitcoin to the balance sheet, overall the company can have higher volatility because they have more Bitcoin. Is that what you're trying to point out?
No, I'm trying to point out that Strategy doesn't clip the volatility to pay the dividends.
Okay, well, from what I heard from Saylor, and I believe to quote him exactly, is that we strip the volatility out of it to pay a yield. He uses the word strip all the time.
Strip the volatility out of the prefs.
Yeah, I stripped of all the other prefs to pay the yield. I use the word clip instead of strip, but he's reducing the volatility with the prefs in order to pay the yield.
We got Clippers and strippers here.
Clippers and strippers. I'm not going to touch that one. Okay. Clippers or strippers. So what I'm trying to say
that makes sense. They're stripping the volatility from the prefs. That excess volatility is going to the common stock. That makes the common stock more attractive. They're able to use that as an ATM for the
right. And the common indirect. Stock is the most volatile one. It's the most volatile one. Okay. Yeah. So my point about this is, if strategy is right, which I think they are, I want to own as much of that company as possible. So if I need either quarterly or monthly payments, I would buy the prefs. It's not all or nothing. I could buy Stretch. There's almost very little or no upside in the underlying price of it. If I want Strike gives you more upside than it, and it gives you less yield or yield depending upon how it trades. My point here is this, is that if you think that strategy is right and issuing digital credit will become the next form of attacking the bond market and the money market funds, I would want to own a part of that company. That's the simple equation. If you agree with that.
And what's it worth?
I think it's worth a lot more than what it is right now.
Yeah. It's funny. The chief marketing officer at Strive asked me the other day, he's like, how long do you think you're going to work at this company? And I giggled. I totally giggled because my response was, I think this might be the last company I ever work for. I think there might be one, you know, it's like, what is this company worth? Like a lot more than what, like anybody is willing to sell it for.
You know what? One of the weirdest things in Silicon Valley is somebody says they're a serial entrepreneur and they always sell off a company. I'm like, okay, if the company is so good, why are you selling it off? Right. Yeah. The reason why they're selling it off is because they got paid so much money that they don't think it's going to continue to go up. Right. Cause if they sell it and it continues to go up, that means they sold it too early. So, but that logic is lost on these guys.
Totally. Well, you kind of like reach this economies of scale and you're like, all right, I got to pull the parachute now. Cause I think the risk of going any further here doesn't make a ton of sense. And an example of this, I saw a chart the other day. It was showing Zoom, the company that does like the web software. It was showing their earnings over time. And then it was tracked with the stock price next to it. And so like, as earnings were growing really quick, like right during COVID, the stock was like booming and then earnings flatlined, stock crash. And it's like, well, where does Zoom go from here? Right? Like somebody can create a Zoom app. Mike, you could probably go create a Zoom app on AI today.
Yeah. And you know, one of the craziest parts about this, everybody's talking about Zoom in 2020, right? Because that's when COVID hit and Zoom, we're going to do a Zoom call. I'm sitting there like this. I didn't buy the stock, right? And I'm like, really? I'm going to date myself. During the internet bubble, when I was at Global Crossing, I provisioned the circuits on the back end for WebEx. I had been using video conferencing literally for 20 years. And I was the guy that provisioned and sold those deals to WebEx, which got acquired by Cisco. So my point here about this, like, oh my God, you just heard about Zoom. We had to convince people back in the old days, like, oh, you're going to have video on a call. And so many people were dead set against this. It's like, yeah, but you had to go to the office anyway. Why are you dead set against this? So the question is like, oh, Zoom came out. You're right. Where's it going to go from there? That's when you see when the founders sell off because there's no longer any upside left in it. Right. Right.
But when you have a huge Bitcoin balance sheet and the preferred equity vehicle, it's just like, why would I don't think there's anything better than this. I think there's like just a few companies on the planet that have this vehicle structure. It's just, it's really appealing. It's really appealing. And I think the company could last for 1,000 years, you know, it's a very interesting dynamic, right? Like these companies, like if Zoom were to have Bitcoin on the balance sheet, maybe the stock performance would be significantly different, right? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm gonna go back to what you said about risk from all these companies. I had posted that I use Claude. I'll I'll explain this very, very quickly what happens and why risk is not priced correctly. So I saw all these video, all these posts about Claude. So I'm not a computer programmer. My degree's in economics. I don't write code. I can do configurations though for routers and switches and set that up in computer networking. Anyway, so what do I do? I'm like, I always want to do an iPhone app. So what do? I go into ChatGPT, tell it to write the MVP, and I tell all the parameters that I want to be in the app. And I say, make sure you write it so it works for Claude. I never logged into Claude. Log into Claude with my Google account. By the way, it's free. Paste it into it. Claude goes, cool. We'll write up the app for you. It writes up the app. It does it in seven different modules. I don't know why it did seven modules. Now I want to emulate that iPhone app. So then I download Xcode, right? Because I'm a Mac guy. Guess how much Xcode is? It's free. Download Xcode, paste the code from Claude into Xcode, and then I emulate it on my Mac and I wrote an app. So now, if you've got me, let's be very clear about this. I'm a reasonably intelligent guy, but when it comes to writing iPhone apps, I'm an idiot. I'll be very clear about it. I never wrote one before. Guess what? I didn't write the code. I used Claude. I did that all in an hour, right? The scary part was the functionality that I wanted in the app. I tested it first in ChatGPT. ChatGPT got 70% of the functionality by itself natively. So now my point
is crazy.
That's why what happens with this, what's going to happen in the future, this is what's going to happen with AI. You're going to be rewarded on your creativity, your motivation to go do something, and the fact, can you complete it? Now, once you complete it, if it makes no money, you don't do anything with it again. That's what happens. And so now what's going to happen with all these companies, and I would be really scared about this. Wow, we built a company with 1,000, 5,000, 10,000. What happens if another company can replicate all of our functionality and do it with 1/10 or 1/100th of the people? Yeah. That is frightening.
Totally.
So, hey, one last thing. I wrote a book on AI. It's going to go live and probably tomorrow or the next day. It's a pretty good book. So you guys will check it out. I'll post. You had to stay on here to hear it first from me. By the way, the book will not generate enough money for me for part of it. But I now have this clarity of thought about how AI works by writing this. So anyway, cool. With that said.
All right. Well, we'll jump into a quick session on Bad Bond of the Week. And I'm just going to jump into it here.
Bad bonds, what you gonna do when Bitcoin come for you? Bad bonds, yields falling through.
Stretch, strike, stride, and strife coming.
Whoa. Digital credit, don't miss.
Whoa.
Blaze coupons, legit.
Now that everybody's got that stuck in their head for the next little while, we are going to look at the Saks bond. I'm sharing my screen. Everything is super laggy today. Sorry about that. Sorry about the audio. I follow this guy, Junk Bond Analyst. It's been just a ton of fun watching all of these junk bonds that he posts about. He posts about all of these junk bonds and like what's happening with them. All of the bankruptcies. So if you want to learn about junk bonds and follow along what's happening, it's so crazy what's happening in this market for yields that are very similar to the perpetual preferred equities, and they just have significantly more risk. And I'll explain why here. So you look at Saks. So the luxury fashion retailer. Have you heard of Saks Fifth Avenue? This is that same Saks.
Oh, so Grain has.
That Grain has heard of Saks Fifth Avenue. He's had to buy some presents in his day. You know, when you buy a Ferrari, you got to go get the ladies something from Saks too. So Saks skipped a debt coupon payment while negotiating with creditors amidst a potential Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing. In December of 2024, okay, not that long ago, Saks raised $2.2 billion to finance its acquisition of Neiman Marcus via Jefferies. Jefferies is a private credit like banking institution. They sold the deal to investors. Just 6 months later, those bonds were trading at 25 cents. So basically, what was worth $2.2 billion in December of 2024 is now worth, $550 million just 6 months later. And The creditors conducted an aggressive liability management deal that rearranged repayment priorities and again injected $700 million of fresh capital to fund the business. So what happens in this is they go back to investors and say, hey, like the deal's not going, you know, deal's not going super well. This is falling apart. Like we need $700 million more dollars, but we're going to strip some debt payments on top of this and we'll put you senior in the capital stack just so we can figure out how to do this bankruptcy. And so those new notes, those $700 million of additional fresh capital that came in the door today trade at 37 cents. So you got $700 million that came in the door and now it's trading at like $250 million, something like that. And while the reprioritized notes from a year ago trade at just 7 cents. So those original $2.2 billion of bonds now trade at 7 cents. So they're worth, I don't know, $100 million, $70 million, something like that, maybe less. And that additional $700 million of capital that came in the door is worth 37 cents of what that original value is. So this is the type of stuff that's happening in the market. Like, how do you underwrite this? I just can't believe that people are signing up to just get punched in the face again. Like, it's just like
I want you to spend more time. I can't understand how any bond salesman or underwriter or whatever, book runner or investment bank, whoever that was for this, I don't know how they could sell this, right? Because, you know, I heard there's a company called, look, I get that Saks Fifth Avenue and Neiman Marcus are luxury goods, but I just don't know how they're able to pitch this to institutional investors, why this makes any sense. Can anybody explain this to me?
I don't get it.
And by the way, after it crashes, they go back to different people, and you think they would do some form of due diligence and be like, well, the previous ones are down 70 or 80%. So we want to come in now because all of a sudden we think Saks is going to rocket back up because they bought Neiman Marcus.
Yeah. So
I can't figure it out.
I think the crazy part about it, well, it's like, okay, so there's a couple things going on here. One, it's just showcasing that these are illiquid, right? Like the new notes are trading at 37 cents. The old notes are trading at 7 cents. Basically, nobody wants to buy them. Okay. That means you have to go through the bankruptcy proceeding to go get your money back. How much money is going to be left at the end of the bankruptcy proceeding? I don't know. I don't want to do the analysis and I don't want to be a part of it to find out. That's what makes the price of these things. Because like, why would you? Like, who cares? Like, this is the last thing that I want to spend my time doing is underwriting like the balance sheet of this, all of the stores, all of the inventory in all these stores. How do you liquidate it? Like, what is liquid? Is there anything liquid? And like, it's just a horrible deal. And I just can't believe people signed up to get punched in the face multiple times, even after recognizing this stuff is already done poorly. It's just crazy.
And the other part, we've talked about this before when I talked about the Blockbuster, when they went bankruptcy, they had a $1 billion bond and they had leaseholds. Somebody's like, oh, well, they bought these bonds because they'll give them a claim on real estate. No, I'm sure if we do 2 seconds worth of analysis here, they don't own the building or the real estate. And so I was like, how could a leasehold be valuable? A leasehold is valuable in the case of Blockbuster because they needed that in order to generate revenue or cash flow. And then that would pay the bond. They're like, okay, we get it. Well, when you declare bankruptcy, then there's virtually no cash flow, right? Or it's completely impaired. So at that point, then the leasehold becomes a liability because you just want to close down stores, but you have to continue paying for a lease that you no longer use. So this is like a disaster that unfolds that any of us would look at and be like, this makes no sense, right? So I will guess right now, and this is clear because in San Francisco, while Union Square has come back and Neiman Marcus is absolutely gorgeous, that is a gorgeous store. You could eat in the corner with glass on multiple levels. It's absurd. It is and you go in there and you see professional football players. It's completely awesome, Neiman Marcus. But on the exact opposite corner is the empty Saks Fifth Avenue. And they took off all the names and logos, but you could see because, you know, the sun hit it. And so while that has recovered, you're like, there's no way, nobody really wants, Saks is not going to reopen that location. It's not.
No way.
So I just see this and I'm just like, I want to meet that salesman one day because that's the best salesman in the world. He sold crap twice.
He sold a pile of crap twice. I mean, that's what makes these digital credit things so exciting. It's like they look really good from a risk perspective. Like you don't have to underwrite inventory across stores across the globe and speculate on people liking those luxury goods. Like, are they going to like those luxury goods a year from now? I have no idea.
And let me give you guys another thing that'll come in with this. This is not a guess. There's two things that are happening here. First of all, in June of 2025, they went back to resell this. Everybody knows that Trump instituted the tariffs, which means if they're luxury goods, they're imported from outside the United States. So now all of a sudden, the price of your goods go up just because of the tariffs. Oh my God. It's due to additional taxes. What do rich people hate doing? They hate paying more money for the same thing. It's not that they can't afford to do it, but that becomes another headwind. But they still were able to sell these bonds, even though everybody knows about the freaking tariffs.
Yeah.
Again, I would like to meet I want to meet the salesperson. I will pay for dinner if somebody finds the guy. Pay 10 grand for the dinner with this guy because I just want to hear how smart this guy is.
Well, you brought up strippers and clippers earlier. I mean, I'm sure there's some of that going on. Soleil, you had some perspective. You were thinking about these things.
Oh no, I was just gonna say with their financial situation, maybe they should just start a GoFundMe.
OnlyFans, Saks Fifth Avenue OnlyFans. Yeah. I mean, just toe picks from all of the employees. That might do it. I mean, who knows these days? And then you YOLO that into some call she bets, and maybe the bonds are worth something. Okay, there's one more thing I wanted to talk about and before we wrap this up, and this is kind of in the theme with bad bonds here. I was doing a bit of analysis on pension funds, and this kind of spooked me a little bit, honestly. And I kind of want to leave people with this thought, because if you've got a pension fund, it might be worth looking into what is in your pension fund, whether that's your state or your local company. And so what you're seeing here on the graph, this is pension fund funded ratios by category as of 2025. And I use Perplexity to come up with this analysis. So, yep, you know, don't take this as fact, but like, I think it's probably directionally correct. And I looked at corporate pension funds, public pension funds, and just wanted to see like how funded are they? How underfunded are they? We talked about this on the hurdle rate. So if you're interested in this topic, go listen to this week's hurdle rate podcast, the hurdle rate. Matt Cole, CEO of Strive, myself, Ben Workman, and Tim Kotzman. We unpack things every week, and we did a deep dive into this. But one thing that was really interesting here is this blue bar. So this is public pensions. So think of all state pensions across the entire United States. This is a United States analysis. What this analysis was showing is that public pensions across the United States are 17% underfunded. That's crazy. That's a crazy statistic. 17% underfunded. So if everybody retired today, that means there would be a 17% gap. Like all the money you said you were going to pay out everybody isn't there. 17% is missing. Everybody has 17% less than you said you were going to pay them.
Yikes.
Yikes. Big yikes. Okay. The 50th percentile, the mid-funded pension funds, are 22% underfunded. Okay. Bottom quartile are actually 40% underfunded. Okay. So how do you come up with the delta? You have to take more risk. You have to go further out on the risk curve to come up with the delta. Or you've got to rely on more employees coming in the door that are going to contribute to the pension fund to help make up for that delta in your in the underfunded rate. That's interesting. The reason I brought this up is because I had a conversation with a guy this weekend that kind of spooked me a little bit. He was telling me about his pension from a prior employer, and the employer is pretty. They've got a pretty large pension. They're like a healthcare company, and 60% of the pension was invested in private equity, and 17% of the pension was invested in high yield credit. Okay, so you got 77% of the company is probably in very illiquid things. What happens when 20% of the private equity businesses that you're invested in go tits up because of AI? Like, what happens to your pension fund? That was spooky. He was spooked. And when I was talking to Matt Cole on Monday on the Hurdle Rate Pod, CalPERS, I did an analysis looking at CalPERS. CalPERS had about 20%, 19 or 20% of their portfolio in private equity. Okay, they're a significantly bigger company or significantly bigger operation. They've got more risk, more liability. They kind of can conceptualize that. But yeah, there's so much risk out there in all of these things all over the place, and they're underfunded. They're banking on more employees coming in the door to help fund them, so all of these older folks can retire and pull out on their pensions into the future. There's a lot of risk out there.
Which, Jeff, if we're looking in the future, do you think there's going to be more or less employees? I think the trend is less employees.
Probably less employees, right? So if there are less employees, who's going to make up for the delta in this? So the other question is, right? So if you're 17% underfunded and somebody draws on this, or if you have a big portion of your, past employee population that starts to draw on this, that it doesn't come out proportionally. Right? So they're going to continue to, if you've got all of these boomers that are retiring and going out and they're drawing on the pensions, they're going to get paid 100%. So you have a disproportionate impact that's having an impact on all of the younger people that are putting into these pension funds. They're millennials or Gen Z that are getting pension funds if they're still around. Most everybody's shifted to 401k these days, but this is a big issue. And it's an issue on the state level. You've got state level employee. What happens when a state level pension fund they start not paying the boomers that think that they're going to get the money from the pension fund? You have civil unrest. You have people that are very pissed off. What does that look like? And I don't know the answer to that. How do you fix that? Can you fix it? Can you prevent it?
Guys, I could tell you a horror show from personal understanding. So by a strange confluence of events, the first company worked at in Silicon Valley, I left that company, and due to a weird scenario, I ended up at a startup that basically fizzled out, and I was there for 3 months, and it was weird. So I got a job at Nortel. So I joined Nortel. You'll see how it's really, really in a second. And so they onboard me, and they have a pension, and the pension paid 3% of your gross base pay. I'm like, okay. So then what I do is I sign up for the 401k, and I do just a regular contribution. So I don't know, a month later or something, I'm like, guys, this is kind of weird, but I checked and it seems to be legal. I'm signed up I'm paying for the 401k and the pension. And a whole bunch of people said to me, this is 2005, this is not like the old days. They're like, why would you do your own 401k if you get a free pension? And I'm like, what? It's like, what? I'm like, I'll do the double dip, right? This makes total sense. Anyway, this is where the horror show happens. So I was there for about a year. They did a reverse split. The company was, it was 100 years old, and it basically imploded. At the peak of the internet bubble, it was 50% of the Canadian stock market, Nortel. Anyway, so I leave the company, and I had told people, I just told them, I said, I can't believe you people never did the 401k. They've been there for 20, 25 years. So I leave the company. 6 months later, Nortel liquidates. I get phone calls from a bunch of people. They're like, what happens to my pension? I'm like, I don't know. Why are you calling me? And they're like, they never did. People worked there for 20, 25 years and never did the 401k because that was less money out of their paycheck. Now there's a pension guarantee corp that went in. This is why the 401ks and IRAs came out, because of the exact problem you're talking about. These people had no idea what I'm talking about, none whatsoever. And that hit a whole bunch of people that put 25 years in at Nortel. I get that this is old, right? Everybody's saying, oh, why are you talking about something that happened 20 years ago? The people just could not price in any form of risk. And they thought this company would live forever. Free. Because it was free, and that's why they didn't have to do it. So after I left the company, a month later, I applied, and I was able to get this. I filled out the paperwork in triplicate and mailed it back in. Got a form, printed it all out, mailed it back in, and I rolled the pension into my IRA account.
Yeah.
And it was non-taxable. It never grew again, but I didn't have to worry about this. And I, again, so, you know, Jeff, when you talk about these things in theory, this is all real stuff. I don't know how people, I don't think that anybody just says to them, could you explain to me why you bought this?
Yeah. And what an interesting thing that Matt was explaining is like the people that are running CalPERS or like the investment that are making the investment decisions are appointed politicians. They're not finance people. So if you want to go talk to them and tell them, hey, like, why don't you consider this digital credit? If they started today, the earliest that they could potentially start adding this instrument to the pension fund is probably like 3 years from now, if they started today. And so you've got this like concept of you've got to have track record. Nobody's going to take this risk for something that's newly issued. And there's probably going to be a sort of hockey stick pattern of adoption on these digital credit instruments. And there's this short period of time, probably the next 3 years, where this outsized alpha is available for the rest of the market before these things are rated, the people that understand them, and the adoption grabs hold in the rest of the traditional financial market. Because even if they started today, it's going to take time in order for these things to come in the door at these places. And one other graph I'm going to share here, which is, maybe dark mode is not the way to do this, but asset allocation of the top 10 U.S. state pension funds from 24 to 25. And so I've got CalPERS, CalSTRS, so California, New York, Florida, Texas, and New York Teachers, Wisconsin, Washington. And what this shows is the breakdown of assets in each of these pension funds. And a couple of things stood out to me is just the large portion in public equity and the large portion in private equity and watching and just seeing how that is, it's over 50%. Like those two components are over 50%. And we've spent a lot of this show talking about potential equity risk. Right. And so if there is this potential equity risk in the market, like how do these things change? These are large, large pools of capital with large assets under management, with large liabilities. And I think it's just good to be, I don't want to like scare everybody, but I think it's just good to be aware that, you know, pensions do have risk associated with them. And not all pensions are the same. Like if you just say you have a pension fund, like a company that provides you a pension fund is different from a state that's providing you a pension fund. They're investing in different things. They have different liabilities. They're probably worth looking into in general. Yeah, they're not all risk-free. Anyway, okay, so we're at 2 hours, bored everybody to death on risk. Let's do a go around. We'll pass it to everybody, do final thoughts. And we will see you at some point next week. Thank you, Tim, for being around for the entire episode of The Hardest Working Man in Bitcoin. I'm going to go to you. Final thoughts after watching everything here.
I'm just excited to have Mike on the Bitcoin Treasuries podcast tomorrow. I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to sleep fast and get up, do some meetings tomorrow, and then hang out with Mike. So I'm super excited. Before we started, I think maybe it was just you and Mason, Jeff, but I said, I'm excited. If you're not excited, your exciter is broken. So I just think 2026 is going to be astronomically unbelievable. I just look at every single thing that could be possibly in our favor, from interest rate trajectory to digital credit instruments. And then you overlay that with sentiment, and it's just kind of hilarious. So those are my final thoughts.
Yeah, most of all the financial people in large institutions, like, they're not even on X. They don't even know this stuff is happening. But they may be working in the space. Like, there are a lot of people that are working in the Bitcoin space. They can't even access X, which is funny. Like, I've spoken with many of them, actually, and that they just have no idea about, like, the Hurdle Rate Pod or True North Podcast, what we're talking about, or anything like this. Yeah.
Also, kind of doesn't make sense, but or doesn't matter, but I like that now that Dan's beside me, it looks like we share a wall, kind of.
Oh yeah.
Like, we're right beside each other.
All right. Over to you, Dan.
I think 2026, there's a Druckenmiller quote out there about 2026. Anyone saying that they know what's going to happen in 2026 is lying. It's one of the most unpredictable market environments that he's ever seen. So I don't feel like I have any place making any predictions, but I do think the outlook is strong for Bitcoin adoption over the long term, and the best thing to do is expect the unexpected.
Right. So Dan says God candles Bitcoin at a million at the end of the year, and he knows all of the things. I think you're right, Dan. There's everything, people are working in the space. We have no idea where this is going to go. A lot of people are working hard and things look bullish. Over to you, Mike.
Yeah, look, Tim, can't wait to do this tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to it. We've never done a podcast together, so that'll be awesome to do it. Dan, congratulations. What you're doing with Buck, being involved with us and everything you're doing, putting together, is awesome. I agree with you with what Druckenmiller said. I totally get it. It is incredibly hard to figure out what's going to happen this year. And I will just quote Finding Nemo. Keep on swimming. No matter what happens, just keep on swimming. And if you get into that current and you go faster, awesome. If you don't, that's the only thing you can do. Just keep on building, doing it, and new things will come up. Did I think I was going to end up writing books? No, I didn't think that. Anybody said to me, you write a book? I'm like, no, why would I do that? So just keep on swimming. Who knows what happens? So,
yeah, this is the most exciting story in all of finance. And keep talking to people. If you're not talking to people, you have, like that lady that's in New York, head of housing now, talking about owning property is racist. So, like, yeah, keep talking about this stuff and try to talk to other people. It's really powerful. And keep on swimming. Just keep showing up, like Soleil, who's shown up for, what, 546 episodes in a row?
Mm-hmm.
546 episodes in a row.
That's a lot of fun.
And they're always, it's always an all-time high on number of episodes. Always.
That's right.
It's great.
Tomorrow's a new all-time high.
Final thoughts, Soleil. What do you got?
All right. So from an option seller's perspective, there's this guy that I really like. His channel's called Real P&L. And he's one of the only guys that sells courses that's like legitimately shares his P&L. So he's not a scammer. And he's one of the guys that actually inspired me to cover my trades the way that I do. And but one of the cautionary tales that he has for someone who just holds stock or sells options is that, you know, the stock can just go to zero, right? If they get disrupted, they can just go to zero. And then you're just left holding nothing, right? You're just holding thin air at that point. But if you are holding a Bitcoin treasury company, even if the 1x MNAV bears are correct, the bear case isn't zero. The bear case is 1x MNAV. And if they're trading at leverage, it's plus whatever their leverage amplification is. So it's never ripe for disruption like other stocks are. So I think it's kind of like the cure for anyone who is, like, you know, just worried that, okay, my computer chips are going to get disrupted, or whatever product and service you have is going to be disrupted. You can't disrupt the Bitcoin balance sheet.
Bingo. Yep, completely agree. Yeah, it's you have ultimate flexibility. And you know that there's value. Like, having the commodity asset on their balance sheet, yeah, you know that there's always value there. So like if you take out the tail risk of Bitcoin going to zero, which you're like, okay, is the internet going to break? Is there going to be a global EMP? Okay, well, I've got guns and whiskey for that, for that situation. And if that doesn't happen, then like, I'm going to keep operating this in this lane, which you got it. You're nailing it. Cool. Over to you, Mason.
Yeah, I have a quote as well today from...
Oh, your audio's awful again.
Oh, man.
Okay,
God damn, it's a good quote. Yeah. Here, I'm going to... Do you think it's my connection or my mic?
Oh, man, I have no idea.
I think it's your connection. Open up the door and maybe the Wi-Fi will flow through the door. Doorway.
Oh, that's a good quote. Whatever.
It's your connection. We can't hear you. Drop it in the chat. Drop your quote in the chat and get mesh Wi-Fi. Okay. My final thoughts. Oh, actually, before that, if you like this, please like and subscribe. Apparently, we're supposed to say that now. This is the Investment Grade Bitcoin Podcast. We've talked about stuff like this for the last 60 weeks in a row. We're out here analyzing this stuff. We are working behind the scenes. Many people are working in the industry now, and we've got a really unique perspective of what's actually happening here. So the YouTube channel is called BTC True North. Go check it out. All of our live videos are there. The X page is MSTR True North. Go check us out there. We all have X handles. Those will be available within the YouTube channel. You can look in the description. You can see all that stuff out there. So please like, subscribe, follow along. That helps us out. Appreciate the support. My final thoughts are, in my opinion, the four-year cycle is broken. The four-year cycle is now broken forever. I think the OG sellers that were focused on selling here and with the potential of buying back lower at 60K later down the road, I think that probability is incredibly low. And I think the architecture of the market has completely changed. And I think what we will see with Bitcoin price action moving forward will be significantly different than times past. And it could just be a grind higher in perpetuity with volatility along the way. I think the years of 80% drawdowns are gone. And now that these instruments are tapping all different capital markets at different periods of time, there is significantly different ways to buy Bitcoin at different periods of time. And you're seeing it now, right? Like companies like Strategy, Metaplanet, our company, we have been buying Bitcoin, even though the price of the price of Bitcoin has been down. So like that can extend into the future because these products exist. And I think that's a fascinating development in the market. And that's only going to be bigger as the years move forward. Mason, we'll try one more time with a new connection. And he's on mute.
Can you guys hear me?
What do you got? I can hear you loud and clear.
Better.
You can? You can? Okay.
Yes. Yes.
I heard a quote today from... Okay. I heard a quote from Mel Madison today. He said, when the market gives you opportunities to buy, there's no narrative in the zeitgeist to reinforce buying. And that's why conviction matters. So I'll leave it there. Thank you, guys. I think this will be a good year.
Right on.
Bullish 2026. I've got the bull right behind me. We're going higher. Appreciate it.
We'll see. One last plug. We'll see everybody in Vegas.
Come hang out in Vegas. Yeah, we'll post that in the chat. Come hang out in Vegas. We'll meet everybody in person and we'll have a great time. Yeah.
Good night.
Awesome.
See ya. Good night.